Good afternoon. My name is Tanaya, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Healthcare Reform, an Overview of Key Concepts conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. Later, we will conduct an interactive question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during that time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. You will hear a tone acknowledging your request and a prompt to record your name. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press star, then the number two. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Scott Becker. Thank you, Mr. Becker. You may begin your conference.
Great. Thank you very much. This is Scott Becker. I'm a partner at McGuire Woods Law Firm and the former chair of our healthcare department. We're going to talk this afternoon about healthcare reform. The core concepts we're going to go through today are five different key points on it. First, we're going to provide an overview of what has been discussed as the overriding goals of healthcare reform. Second, we'll talk about the public plan or public option and what that entails and what that means. Third, we'll talk about the goal or concept of covering the uninsured and some of the ways in which that has been approached, sort of covering the uninsured / full access. Fourth, we'll talk about paying for health care reform, some of the methods that have been discussed in the different plans for paying for health care reform. Currently, the most recent pricing on reform is about $1 trillion+ over 10 years, and even with increased taxes and surcharges, the latest reports still show it costing $240 billion over a 10-year period. Finally, we will discuss a number of the other key issues that have been touched upon with respect to healthcare reform, things like the idea of a healthcare exchange and some of the other concepts that have been discussed as part of healthcare reform. With that introduction, let me start talking about some of the core concepts that drive the thinking on healthcare reform. The talk that we'll give today, just as background, is intended to be as politically neutral as possible. Obviously, we live personally in the world of healthcare providers, so we have certain biases that we start with in terms of concern on what healthcare might do to reimbursement. But as an overall goal, we'll try and be extremely politically neutral in the discussion today. In terms of the core concepts, there's three core ideas with respect to healthcare reform that are often talked about. First is cost containment, and that's both at a federal level and at an individual/employer level. And how do you rein in the overall cost of healthcare, whether it's an employer paying for healthcare or whether it's evolving Medicare and federal deficits as they relate to healthcare? Second is full access, or the concept of covering the uninsured. How do you provide coverage to those people that are in the category, you know, often roughly estimated at 45 to 47 million people that don't have healthcare coverage? And later on in the talk, we'll specifically discuss who is in those categories, in that $45 to $47 million category. A third core concept is one of high quality. Can you achieve cost containment, full access, and also maintain a very high quality system? In terms of the president's discussion of the overriding views of healthcare reform, he has talked most extensively about two concepts, that of cost containment and full access. Very little of the discussion has been about quality, with him putting the premium on cost containment, at least in discussion, and on full access and covering the uninsured. It's commonly perceived by many parties that it is possible to achieve two out of three of the goals, meaning you can get to cost containment and you might be able to get to full access, but it's very hard to do those two plus maintain a very high-quality healthcare system. In contrast, you could have not cover everybody, have high quality, and possibly still have some level of cost containment, but the overriding concept of hitting all three goals, cost and containment, high quality and full access is the sort of combination of things that's been very hard to achieve. And in fact, in almost all of the discussions, the real focus in this healthcare reform bill has been on full access, i.e. covering the uninsured, and discussions of cost containment, although after you see the Congressional Budget Office estimates, it's hard to see where some of the cost containment is really coming from or will evolve from. Currently, in terms of further background on healthcare reform, there's three core health plans that are being discussed. First, there's a plan in the House of Representatives that's at least been passed in committee in the House. And then two, there's two different Senate plans, one in the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, and one in the Senate Finance Committee. And we'll, as we get into the discussion further, we'll talk about how these three plans differ, whereas really the Senate Finance Committee plan differs significantly. And in contrast, the Senate Help Plan or Help Committee plan and the House plan are much more similar to each other. Concepts that are discussed in terms of cost containment go from the politically palatable and easy to sell to the much less politically palatable. The easy ones to sell that make for relatively easy rhetoric politically are cutting fraud, cutting waste, moving to electronic concepts, and developing a health system based on quality but not on based on procedures or quantity of procedures. All of these things sound good. They're easy to sell. There's not a huge amount of objection to them theoretically, but very hard to implement and very hard to implement in a manner that will really drive down substantial cost. When you talk about the concept of we want to pay for health care based on quality, not procedures, to some of us, that sounds like a movement back towards a fully capitated system where, and then on top of that, the concept of judging payment for quality seems to be, to most observers, fairly subjective, but it's an easy political thing to say. We want to pay for quality, not for procedures. Those are sort of the politically palatable, easy to discuss things. The harder things to discuss when you talk about cost containment in healthcare reform are raising taxes to pay for it, rationing care, or lower reimbursement. Those seem to be the three much tougher issues to really deal with, but at the end of the day, it's very hard to get to true healthcare reform without addressing some of the tougher subjects and not just fraud and abuse, waste, electronic, and some of these other ideas or technology. In terms of a couple overriding issues that, whether on the right or left, I think most people have a significant amount of sympathy for are as follows. One is finding some means to cover people that have pre-existing conditions that, because of their pre-existing conditions, can't obtain coverage. That's something I think in terms of the bucket of the uninsured of the 45 to 47 million, most people have sympathy for people in that situation. A second spot that I think, you know, and again, some of this will be discussed in more detail in the covering of the uninsured, but wanted to provide some background at this point, is the concept of providing health care coverage for what I would refer to as the working poor or those people that live above the federal poverty level and aren't eligible for Medicaid, but if they bought health insurance or if their employer bought health insurance, it would take up such a disproportionate amount of their income that it makes it very hard for them to buy health insurance. And those might be people that earn anywhere between 200% to 400% of the federal poverty level in real numbers, $40,000 to $60,000, but if you have a family of four and healthcare costs are $12,000 to $14,000 a year, there's two big problems. If you have to buy it yourself, it's very expensive. If, in contrast, your employer has to buy the coverage for the person, then it also drives up the cost of hiring people significantly. And I think, by and large, while there's a whole bunch of disagreement on healthcare reform as a whole, I think people have sympathy for those two situations, i.e. people with pre-existing conditions and people that are working poor, where the cost of serious health care coverage and insurance coverage is just a huge part of their income. Moving to the second part of the talk, that which we describe as the public option. The public option is one of a couple of what we would call the third rails of the healthcare discussion, in that it brings out very serious differences of opinion as to what a health, whether there should be a public option and what it would look like. There's essentially three types of public options that have been discussed generally in Congress. The first is what one refers to, or Ezra Klein of the Washington Post refers to, as the strong public option. The strong public option essentially allows the government to take advantage of the Medicare system. It doesn't have to renegotiate new contracts. It essentially pays providers Medicare plus 5%. And this is the plan that is very much favored by the House of Representatives. From a provider standpoint, the overriding concern with what's considered the strong public plan is that providers typically get paid 20 to 30% less by Medicare and governmental plans than they do by commercial plans, and any migration away from commercial plans to a strong public plan would directly impact provider income, and we'll discuss that in a few moments. The second type of plan is what's considered a middle plan or a moderate plan, and this essentially allows the government to take advantage of some of the Medicare infrastructure, but it has to then go ahead under the middle plan to negotiate rates with all providers anew, and is really just a second or another type of insurance company versus truly a Medicare infrastructure type plan at Medicare plus 5% rates. There's not a ton of interest in the second plan for concern that it would get bogged down in administrative cost and wouldn't be able to make nearly the sort of progress on one hand with healthcare cost, on the other hand, harm to providers and insurers that people see with the strong public plan. The third type of public plan is generally called the weak or trigger plan, and this is something that's been more well thought of by Senator Baucus and Republicans and some middle-of-the-road Democrats. And a trigger plan only goes into effect if at some point in the future the changes to health care reform, absent a public plan, don't have the effects that are intended. So in terms of the plans that are out there, the House of Representatives and the Congressional Health and the Senate Health Committee are pretty much in favor of a strong public plan, which is essentially would pay providers Medicare plus 5%. The Senate Finance Committee, Senators Baucus, Grassley, and his group of colleagues, which is an important litmus test here, have right now been against a public plan and at best have endorsed the concept of a trigger plan, one that would come into being if, in fact, there was certain targets weren't met in healthcare reform absent a public plan. In terms of the strong public plan, and I'm using words that have been used by commentators not intended to endorse a strong public plan, the core benefit and negative sort of go hand in hand. It's estimated that a strong public plan, and these are estimates from the Lewin Group, who studied this and then testified to Congress, that a strong public plan would reduce premiums for a family of four by approximately $200 a month, from about $917 a month to $740 a month, and that's in part the appeal of the plan. Similarly, for individuals, it would drop insurance premiums per month by $80 to $90 per month. So again, a significant reduction in potential premiums and cost, driving down health care cost for a family to roughly $9,000 from roughly $11,000 to $12,000. The flip side of this is because of the reduced cost of premiums in the public plan, the Lewin Group estimates and other parties have estimated a huge migration by the time that the plan is fully put into place of approximately 120 million people away from what are private commercial plans and into what are the public plans. in essence, putting a great percentage of the country either on Medicare or a public plan. In terms of the impact on providers nationally of such a change and such a migration, it's been estimated as follows, that in terms of by the time this was fully ramped in, after about 3 to 4 years, that the total negative impact on hospitals would be approximately $30 billion collectively, and that the total negative impact on physicians would be approximately $11 billion, or roughly about $16,000 per physician in the country. In terms of why this is the case, it's quite simple. Hospitals right now are paid by Medicare approximately 70% of what they're paid by commercial plans. Physicians on average are paid about 80% of what they're paid by commercial plans. So a huge migration over from commercial plans to a lower paying payer leads to a very significant reduction in the amount of reimbursement that hospitals and physicians receive. You'd obviously see the same kind of dichotomy with other types of providers that rely heavily on commercial reimbursement for their profitability. Surgery centers, of course, are in the same bucket, typically get paid 75 to 80% by Medicare compared to what they get paid by commercial plans, and so a large migration away from commercial plans to Medicare or Medicare Plus 5 would generally have a very negative impact on surgery centers. In terms of different perspectives on the plan, there should be on the www.beckersasc.com website a paper and PowerPoints that put forth a couple quotes or paragraphs of four different perspectives on the public plan. One is the perspective of, well, two perspectives that are essentially in favor of a public plan, one from Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor for President Clinton, and second for the Commonwealth Group, have articulate quotes on why they think a public plan is a good thing. Then alternatively, you've got two quotes in the papers, one from Karl Rove, who was in the Bush White House, and one from David Burda, who's the editor-in-chief of Modern Healthcare, on why they believe that a public plan would be economically disastrous for providers. All four are interesting readings. They're all on the website. I don't ask you to go to the website at this point, but you could print off the slides or print off an article that gives an overview of key concepts that will give you at least these four different perspectives. In terms of a handful of writers to follow over the next couple months, as you look at healthcare reform, there's a gentleman, David Hersenhorn at the New York Times, who's done a terrific job of articulating the issues without taking really a position one side or the other on it. Then on the side that's very pro healthcare reform and a public plan is a gentleman named Ezra Klein at the Washington Post. On the other side of the issue is Karl Rove at the Wall Street Journal and Michael Tanner at the Cato Institute. All of these writers are worth reading in terms of getting more information and perspective on what a public plan would look like and what healthcare reform might look like. So the first two issues we've covered today are overriding goals of the plan plus the concept of a public plan, and talk there about the possible premium reduction plus the potential impact on providers of a public plan and why it's such a hot issue. The third issue we're going to cover today is that of coverage or covering the uninsured. The uninsured are generally broken down into three different groups. There are those that are Medicaid eligible, and at least when they did the study in Massachusetts of the uninsured and, you know, was the first state in the country to develop a plan that required everybody to have insurance, they broke these three groups down into roughly equal buckets. First were people that are Medicaid eligible but aren't properly enrolled in Medicaid, so people that make less than a certain percentage of the poverty level but have failed to appropriately enroll in Medicaid. Second is the working poor, and again, the group we talked about earlier, people that make, let's say, 115% to 400% of the federal poverty level income and have a hard time affording insurance at that type of economic situation. And then finally, third is the group, which are often referred to as free riders or healthy people who choose not to get insurance. These are often people, at least traditionally, in their 20s and 30s that could essentially afford insurance but choose not to. Presumably, they don't feel like they have enough money to need to protect themselves from the risk of going bankrupt from a healthcare bankruptcy, but essentially a large group that just choose not to get insurance. When they looked at these three core groups, they essentially broke it down, at least in Massachusetts, and it's probably true nationally as well. So of the 45 million, there's probably 15 million of that 45 that are literally Medicaid eligible, but just that have not enrolled in Medicaid. Second is the working poor, and again, a good percentage of the 45 to 47 million are those. And then the third category is essentially people that can afford coverage or, you know, 20s to 30s, et cetera, that have chosen not to buy coverage. There's also a group, two groups that are discussed a little bit less that aren't maybe as big a group, that are an important group that people have lots of sympathy for. One is certainly those with pre-existing conditions, and everybody knows somebody that can only have coverage if they were at a big company and so needed to stay at a big company and had a very hard time getting coverage if not at a big company. A second group, which was as Massachusetts started to have horrible budgetary problems with their plan to cover all the uninsured, is a group of what are referred to as sort of illegal aliens or people that are in the country that were covered under the Massachusetts plan, for example, 30,000 people. Those are the first people that the state has now said that they're not going to cover under the full access coverage plan. In terms of working through how do you get the full coverage, Massachusetts and now Connecticut, which also this week passed a universal coverage concept, are fairly instructive of some of the concepts being looked at on the federal level. There's four or five different concepts that are looked at for full access or covering all the uninsured. First is the concept of an individual mandate, which essentially says if you're an individual, much like in many states you are required to have auto insurance, you are now required to have health care insurance. And that's really the rule in Massachusetts. You have to have health care coverage. Hand in hand with that goes a concept that says that insurance companies aren't permitted to deny you coverage, and they're not permitted to overly penalize you if you have pre-existing conditions or things that would otherwise prevent you from getting coverage. The second concept, which is also part of the federal concepts on health care reform and full coverage, is to provide people with subsidies that are within a certain federal poverty level percentage. So if you make between $22,000 to $66,000 and aren't eligible for Medicaid, that you would have subsidies or tax credits so that you could put those towards health care coverage. A third concept is to assure that all of those that are Medicaid eligible are in fact enrolled. And one of the core concepts with the federal plan, right now different states have different standards for Medicaid eligibility, is essentially to require all states to standardize what is the formula for determining Medicaid eligibility. The most recent percentages that I've heard or seen are that people would all be considered eligible for Medicaid and should be enrolled in Medicaid if they make 115% of the federal poverty level or less. The third or fourth concept on full coverage in Massachusetts, it wasn't that businesses were mandated to provide coverage. It was that if they didn't provide coverage, they had to provide a tax. They had to pay taxes or a penalty for not providing the coverage. One of the concerns that you see on the right in terms of, or the conservative side of the healthcare argument is that one of the reasons you'll have this huge migration away from commercial plans to the public plans is that even if you had a federal mandate on providing coverage, many businesses would rather pay the tax, depending on how much it is, than actually provide the coverage, that it would simplify their business to not provide it and pay the tax. In terms of the federal plans, there's been four or five things talked about, many similar to what's been done in Massachusetts. First is an individual mandate that, in fact, everybody would be required to have insurance. There's two concepts that really go into this requirement. One is it gets rid of what is considered the freeloader problem, where insurance companies cover everybody but are disproportionately penalized because they're providing coverage to people that are not the most healthy, because it's the most healthy that pay the premiums every month but don't use up the healthcare resources concurrent with their premiums. So an overall individual mandate where everybody's required to get coverage. A second core federal concept is standardizing Medicaid eligibility. And again, the most often number we've heard is the 115% of the federal poverty level. A third concept is subsidizing those people, just like in Massachusetts, that are essentially working but not making enough money where they could afford health care coverage of $12,000 a year plus all their other necessities. So subsidies up to about 300 to 400% of the federal poverty level. The fourth core concept that's been discussed at length on the federal side in terms of full access is employer mandates to provide coverage, and essentially the core mandate that's been discussed is that an employer would have to pay 50% of cost. There would have to be standardized benefit packages, and the federal government, at least on the House side, has divided the standardized benefit packages into four different practices, into four different packages, excuse me. And the third concept on the employer mandate is it would be full-time employees that are required, that fit into this mandate. And the fourth concept on the employer mandate is it only applies to companies above a certain size. So the core concepts are employer pays 50% of the cost, there's a standardized benefit package, and at least the minimum benefit package has to be paid for. It applies to full-time employees, and it applies to larger employees, meaning more than 25, 50 employees. The numbers continue to change on what constitutes a big employer. Two of the interesting concepts on the employer mandate are as follows. The National Chamber of Commerce has essentially taken the position that the employer mandate would be a huge disincentive to hiring full-time employees and would significantly drive up the cost of employing people at a time when many businesses are suffering nationally. The flip side is Walmart recently came out in favor of mandatory coverage, and I think the commentator's perspective on why Walmart came out in favor of it, which led the chambers to react very negatively to Walmart's concept, is that Walmart perceives that almost in all circumstances, they're going to have to pay coverage for full-time employees anyways. And so by them coming out heavily in favor of mandatory coverage, they essentially end up trying to level the playing field with many different types of competitive companies. So it's not that they would start off not really wanting to have the choice, but figuring that they're going to do it anyways, that they might as well have it be a requirement that applies to everybody. It's a really interesting set of facts because the Chamber of Commerce and the other sort of business groups have been very upset about Walmart coming out and endorsing the concept of mandatory coverage by employers. The fourth concept that we're going to talk about this afternoon in terms of healthcare coverage is how will it be paid for nationally and through the tax plans, and there's been a handful of different thoughts that have been put forth. Again, the estimated price tag on the bills, the first Congressional Budget Office scoring of the bill, and the CBO is intended to be entirely nonpartisan, which is often the case, and that often what the CBO comes up with is disliked by a whole range of interest groups, special interest groups, whether on the left or right, which is probably a sign that they're doing a decent job. The first estimate of the first plan that they came up with was approximately $1.6 trillion over 10 years. That was enough to cause the House to take another look at their plan and trim some things from the plan. The most recent CBO scoring of the plan shows a total cost of about $1 billion, and even after all the taxes that have been talked about, a total cost to the country of about $260 billion over 10 years. The ways of paying for the plans, there's been four or five core concepts discussed. First core concept is to tax health care benefits. Right now, as most people realize, your health care benefits that you receive from your employer are not taxed to you, so that when you receive $10,000 in insurance coverage or whatever the number is, you don't pay taxes on that, even though there's a value to you of it. The concept of if you taxed all health care benefits, it's estimated that that would bring in $350 billion a year or so. The concept of taxing all health care benefits is very much disliked on the left side of the equation for a couple of reasons. One, it would be a tax that applies to everybody, regardless of income, so it taxes across the board. It's what on the left people consider a regressive tax versus a progressive tax. And then on top of it, there's a concept from on the left side that a tax on health care benefits would disproportionately be paid by people in urban communities or large metropolitan states, because there's just a lot more people in those places that in total make up the population and are employed in total. So very unpopular on the left, more popular in very low populous states. The second concept, which Senator Baucus and Senator Conrad have talked about, is to not tax all health care benefits, but to only tax health care benefits where the insurance paid on your behalf is more than $17,000 or $25,000 a year, the concept being that you would tax what are considered Cadillac, probably a bad word choice in today's world, or gold-plated benefits. And the concept, again, being that once you reduce this from taxing all health care benefits to only taxing those that are above $17,000 or $25,000 a year, you end up in a position where it brings in $90 billion a year instead of $350 to $360 billion a year. So it reduces significantly the revenue that's generated from bringing in from taxing health care benefits. A second concept that's been talked about, and then we'll get to the most interesting one, is the concept of reimbursement reduction, you know, in exchange for different promises of things that pharmaceutical companies and hospitals would like to see in the plans. The hospitals and pharmaceutical companies have at least very preliminarily discussed concepts that would drive savings on the pharma side of about $55 billion and over 10 years, and on the hospital side of about $150 billion. Many commentators see those reimbursement reductions as somewhat illusory or not real, and so great concern as to whether there really would be those savings, and of course, if they are true savings, what impact it has on the federal health care system. The sort of third core concept that's discussed in terms of paying for health care reform is a common one that seems to be discussed currently, is to tax the wealthiest 1% of income earners, and essentially one of the concepts of the surcharge and above $280,000 a year in income and then a graduated surcharge is that was pegged recently to bring in another $300 to $400 billion over a 10-year period, and that again would be a way towards paying for health care reform. Very popular concept in some districts. Interestingly enough, I saw a stat yesterday where of the 25 wealthiest districts in the country, 14 of them have Democratic congressmen, and all these people that essentially make X amount of dollars vote. And so those 14 congressmen are quite concerned about the concept on the Democratic side of taxing above the top 1% or 2%. Charles Grassley, a Republican who many would argue that he should be called a Democrat or Republican depending on what issue and what day, he essentially, in a sign of modern times, tweeted back the House last week through Twitter, and essentially, you know, with the fact that the top 1% earns 27% of income and currently pays 40% plus of income taxes, thus setting forth sort of the Republican or right side line, plus many moderate Democrats, or what are commonly called the Blue Dog Democrat, concerned with raising taxes to pay for health care reform, particularly when there's plenty of other deficit issues that you might have to raise taxes to pay for as well. In terms of, so I mean, the debate as to how you'll pay for health care reform and how I think many people are starting to understand that if there's truly health care reform and truly an aim to cover all the uninsured through it, that it will be an expensive proposition. In Massachusetts, for example, they essentially, when they passed health care reform with Democratic Congress in Massachusetts and Mitt Romney as the governor of Massachusetts, they essentially took the position, and it was in better economic times, that they would make their first goal covering all the uninsured, and then a couple of the years down the road, they would figure out how to pay for it. They've ended up in a position where it's been much more costly than they anticipated, and so now they're at a spot where they're having to regroup and rethink about it. It's caused one of the major hospital systems in Massachusetts to sue the state government, saying that the payments are below what they can survive on. It's caused them this week to look at dropping illegal immigrants or illegal aliens from the coverage. You know, and people could argue all sides of the issue, but in the, you know, the take home is it's costed a ton more than expected, and it's put serious problems into the budgets in the state of Massachusetts. Interesting enough, Connecticut this week decided that by 2012, they themselves, and they overrid the veto of the governor in Connecticut, that they also would have a universal coverage plan by 2012. Some of the other key issues that are talked about in terms of healthcare reform, and obviously this isn't exhaustive, but a number of the other issues. One of the things that's talked about is a healthcare exchange or a healthcare portal, and there's two different types of this concept. The most simple is the concept that there would be a internet page or website where you could compare cost and benefits of different insurance plans. You know, somebody jokingly said to me the other day, do you mean like an Expedia for healthcare or an Orbitz for healthcare? And it's somewhat along those lines. Essentially, the concept of developing a transparent, monitored website where all insurance plans would have to be a part of so that you could readily compare price and packages. A second concept that's been talked about as one of the issues of healthcare reform is the concept of standardizing benefit packages. And to this end, the government has set forth a low, a medium, and high level of benefits. And then there's some one between low and medium. And essentially the concept being, and it goes hand in hand with this transparency concept and portal concept, that you would end up with four types of standard packages, and so that people could more clearly understand what they're getting and not getting as part of their healthcare package. A third concept is the concept of standardizing Medicaid eligibility amongst all the states so that we had one poverty level that would dictate Medicaid eligibility, and obviously making better efforts to enroll those that are Medicaid eligible into Medicaid, because a big part of the 45 to 47 million that is always sort of talked about in this debate are actually people that are eligible for Medicaid but aren't properly enrolled in Medicaid. In Massachusetts, they estimated that that was at least a third of the population of what was considered their uninsured. A fourth concept is not allowing insurers to deny coverage or to overly vary rates based on pre-existing conditions. Again, from an insurance perspective, I think their perspective or counter to that is you can force us to insure all those with pre-existing conditions as long as everybody, the healthy and unhealthy, are required to have insurance coverage. You can't just force us to take those with pre-existing conditions but not force the healthy into plans as well. A fifth federal concept that's been discussed is the concept of expanding Medicare from 65 and older to 55 to 64. Again, another way of essentially putting more people into a federal government plan and taking it out of the employer responsibility or individual responsibility or commercial situation. Another concept that's been talked about a great deal is employer mandates. We touched on this a little bit earlier, which is would in fact employers be required to provide coverage, and generally the discussion in the House plans and the Senate plans has been along the lines of similar to what you have for COBRA today. If you're above a certain size, you have to provide coverage, and there's different metrics in terms of what type of coverage and how much coverage you have to provide. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to take a handful of questions from the audience, if there are any.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then number 1 on your telephone keypad. You will hear a tone acknowledging your request and a prompt to record your name. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press star, then the number 2. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. At this time, sir, we have no questions from the phone line.
Great. Then we'll end the call. If anybody wants a copy of the paper on healthcare reform and overview of key concepts, please either go to www.beckersasc.com or email myself at sbecker@mcguirewoods.com, and we'd be delighted to provide it to you. Thank you, folks, very much for joining us today.
That concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.